So we have started this series about crossing over, called to cross over. We're looking at the life and the times of Abram and asking questions about what he did and why he did it and how it shapes our lives today. The message today is called Altars Calling, because with this message, we are going to see the beginning of Abram's journey of obedience after his father passes away. His father is the one that led the family from Ur to Haran, if you remember, and now it's going to be time for Abram to start his own journey without dad, without all of that safety and security. So our point of focus is going to be the fact that along the way, even early on, Abram is a man who builds altars. And so we're going to ask the question about those altars. Why did he do it? What did they mean? And what does it mean for us today that Abram built altars on that land? So let's go right to the text, Genesis chapter 12, starting in verse 4, going through verse 9. You can follow along in a Bible if you brought one with you, or simply follow along with the text on the screen behind me. Genesis 12, starting in verse 4. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. And they arrived there. Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. At the time, the Canaanites were in the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord, who had appeared to him. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord, and he called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued toward the Negev. So before we get to the altar specifically, there are two points that I want to make that we see in the text that happen in the text before we start looking at the how and the why of Abram's altar building experience. Here's the first one. Abram is called to make a fresh start, though we may also want to label it a late start. A fresh start and a late start. We're told that after following his father to Haran, Abram is now hearing a call from God to start his own journey at what age? 75. 75. Whew. Right? So I ask this question. At the age of 75, are any of us today ready for a fresh chapter of life that will require risk and energy and perseverance and potentially battles with enemies? Is that what the average 75-year-old is looking forward to? Now, I'm nowhere near 75 yet, although within a couple weeks, I'm going to have a birthday, and I am getting closer and closer to that looming milestone that starts with a 4. It's coming for me. I can feel it. So I'm not even close to being there yet at 75, but sometimes when I think, you know, on my birthday, about the future and what it might hold and what it might look like, I don't imagine 75 being a time that I'm ready to take on the world, to risk. I'm thinking 75 is a time when I'm hoping to be able to maybe slow down and rest and enjoy the benefits of all the risks I've already taken, all the energy I've already spent, all the perseverance I've already gone through, all the battles I've already fought. That's what I'm kind of hoping 75 looks like. But not Abram. At 75, he starts this whole new chapter, a journey of risk and perseverance. Now, to be fair, based on how long we know Abram will live, he's only about 43% of the way into his life. And so, adjusting for that, he would be about where a 32 to 35-year-old would be today. So it's not quite the same. It's not a one-to-one comparison. But I would say this still, once you reach your mid-30s, which I'm quickly exiting, as I've already mentioned, you start to hope that life slows, that there's a rhythm to life, that there are roots that you're putting down in your life on average. So even that still, I look at that and I go, wow, Abram was being asked to uproot a whole lot for this fresh start, kind of midstream. So all of that thinking led me to this conclusion. If you think that God might be done moving you or using you because you've reached a certain age or a place in your life, I want to tell you today, you are most definitely wrong. You're wrong. If you think that when you hit this certain milestone age or this certain place in life that God is done moving you and using you as he sees fit, calling you into new and fresh chapters and adventures that, yes, maybe will involve some risk and some upsetting of whatever apple cart you've built up in your mind. It's clear from Abram's story that God still does crazy things like that. Always be listening and attentive and willing if God calls, no matter where you are in life. So Abram makes this fresh start, and I want to note there's one small detail that crops up in the text, and I want to take an opportunity to hit on it because of the lesson I think it teaches us in a much larger frame, right? It's a very small detail that we probably just kind of skipped over or read over and didn't think much about. Now, small details, I want you to know, matter. Even if they're small, they still matter. I would even say small details matter most when you work with larger distances, right? Small details matter most when you work with larger distances. I've learned this a little bit in my very limited amount of time I've spent doing handiwork around the house, right? Anytime I need to do something that involves, you know, cutting or nailing or screwing down or whatever, I kind of get to the point where I go, how long is this supposed to be again? Or how far apart are these things supposed to be? And I kind of look at it and eyeball it and go, close enough, right? And in most of the projects I've done, not a big deal because we're working with a pretty small scale. But when you work with larger scales, even small details matter tremendously. For instance, if you're off by only a single degree, right? Just think about this for a moment. If you're only off by a single degree in measurement, after 1 foot, you will be off by 0.2 inches. Which is why I typically go, close enough. Because I don't work with larger scales like that, like these ones. Think about this one, though. After 100 yards, you would be off by 5.2 feet. Just by 1 degree, 5.2 feet. As the distance gets greater, it gets to be a bigger problem. Now, I do have a little bit of experience with this because during the summers, during my college years, I worked at my dad's shop here in town at Electric Furnace, and they built these gigantic industrial-sized furnaces for brazing, I think it was called. I don't remember. I try and block a lot of that out if I can. But they had these huge rollers inside that you would, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of feet long. And I remember as a college student, I always got volunteered for the really fun job of when the furnace was almost completed, I'd have to crawl inside and over and under all these rollers and take this tiny little device, a little piece of metal with a bubble on it for leveling, and I'd have to set it on top of the roller, each one, and talk over a walkie-talkie to some guy who was at the very front of it. He's looking through some sort of telescopic device, it seemed to me. I have no idea what that was called either. But I'd have to go roller by roller in the dark so that he could get measurements to make sure that everything was precise. Because after 300 or 400 feet, it makes a big difference. I won't tell you how many times I may have fallen asleep during that part of the job, because you put a college student in a very dark place at 6 o'clock in the morning, probably not going to go well, right? But distance makes things, the small details matter a lot. Let's keep going. After a mile, you'll be off by 92.2 feet. 1 degree. If you travel from San Francisco to Los Angeles, pretty close together in the same state, 1 degree puts you off by 6 miles. Let's go further. If you go from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., and you're off by only 1 degree, you'll end up on the other side of Baltimore, 42.6 miles away from where you intend to be. That small detail gets pretty big. Let's go even bigger. If you travel around the globe from Washington, D.C. and come back and you're off by 1 degree, you're going to miss D.C. on the return trip by 435 miles. You'll end up in Boston. You can have some lobster. But you won't be where you intended to be. If you get in a rocket and you go to the moon and you're off by only 1 degree, you'll end up off by 4,169 miles. Twice the diameter of the moon. If you go to the sun from here and you're off by just 1 degree, you would miss the sun by over 1.6 million miles. over twice the diameter of the sun. And at the top end, consider this, if you just travel from here to the nearest star other than the sun, and you're off by one single degree, you'll end up off course by 441 billion miles. 120 times the distance between here and Pluto. So small details over the span of large distances become more and more important. Now, why do I say all that? Because there's a small detail in this story, this ancient story, that over thousands of years became really, really important. And we find it when we read this word, that Abram, taking from his journey, we're told he took possessions and what else? The people that he acquired. The people that he acquired. If that sounds like it's referencing slavery, it is. Now, some of them may have been servants, some of them may have been paid somehow, but almost certainly some of them would have been slaves. So we come face to face with this small detail that Abram owned and took with him slaves. A very not big deal in the ancient world when this story is being told and written down and shared for generations and thousands of years, not a big deal. Slavery was considered normal. It looked different than maybe we imagine it, but for thousands of years, it was considered normal and acceptable, right? Now, if you think that this is the last time Abram will do or say something that ruffles our contemporary feathers, I want you to know that you're wrong about that. But that small detail ended up being very, very huge thousands of years later to people like our Quaker forerunners, people like John Woolman, who took the long view of Scripture and said, yeah, even though explicitly we're told that Abram owned people, and the law of Moses includes things that tell you how to regulate the slavery, even to the point where how badly can you beat your slaves? You'll find it there, right? And even when you get to the New Testament, what's the general rule of thumb? Slaves, obey your masters. And the reason I bring all of this up is because we need to be able to articulate to people when they ask, and if you haven't had a conversation like this, you will. When somebody says, how can you believe in and follow the Bible when it endorses slavery? And please don't try and just avoid the question or ignore it. That makes things worse. We need to be able to understand how over the long haul, Christians started to wake up to the deep undercurrent in Scripture that every person is created in God's image. But it took a long time. It's only been within the past 200 years or so that people like Woolman and Wilberforce and others started to say, no, this is an evil thing, an evil and sinful thing, even though it receives endorsement all the way through the New Testament. We need to be ready to have those kind of conversations with outsiders, to explain to them how the Bible is still crucially valuable and important and inspired. Even though we find things like this in there, these trouble spots, don't ignore them. Be ready to engage in those conversations about how things turned and changed, because those small details end up making a large difference. All right, so now we get to the actual altar building, right? Abram traveling with his caravan with him, and he builds altars. So I want to look at why Abram did so and what it means for us. The first altar that he built, the first calling that we receive from an altar here in this story is that it's used to remember God's presence. We're told simply that the Lord appeared to Abram. The Lord appeared to Abram. Now in verse 1 of this chapter, we hit on the idea that the Lord said something to Abram. But now things get intensified just a little bit because it's not just God saying something to Abram. We're told that God appears to Abram. In theology, we call this a theophany, an appearance of God. Now, we don't know what this appearance looks like. We don't know, like with Moses, we know, burning bush, right? We don't know. We're not told the details of what this appearing of God looked like to Abram. We have no idea. But all we do know is that it is very clear that God is present with Abram in that place. And as a result, Abram builds an altar. Now that altar, we're not told that there was any sacrifice on it. It's possible that there was. We don't know for sure. There are other instances in the Old Testament where altars were built and sacrifices were not made. I would like to believe that this altar is primarily built because it's a marker of this moment. That Abram did not want to forget this moment where God appeared to him. This place where God appeared to him, where the presence of God was felt in a very powerful and a very deep way. There's an old Celtic Christian term for places where God feels especially near. It's the term the thin places of life. The thin places. And they call it that for this reason. The idea being that heaven and earth are a lot closer than we think. And in those thin places are where you start to feel like those worlds are really starting to touch. Where the walls of the world are kind of crumbling and you feel the realness, the power of God's presence. And it humbles you and it changes you. These thin places are something that I think many of us have experienced. We can think and point back to times when we felt God so clearly present among us. I read an article written by a non-religious journalist, so somebody who has no belief in God or anything like that, but he had heard about these thin places, and he said he had an experience like this. So listen to these words from an outsider, from someone that wouldn't affirm anything about God or Jesus, but this is what he talks about when he experienced something like this. He went to visit, just as a tourist, the painting, Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper. And he said, when I did that, this is what happened. He said, we're in the territory here of the ineffable, the stuff we can't express, because it's beyond the power of language to do so. That's a journalist saying that. Explanations aren't merely useless, they threaten to get in the way. The experience of a thin place feels special because words fail, leaving stunned silence. Anybody who goes through life with an open mind and open heart will encounter these moments of revelation, moments that are saturated with meaning, but whose meaning cannot be put into words. Those thin places. I think that's what Abram was experiencing, and as a result, in that stunned silence, he built this altar, marking this place in this time where God was powerfully present with him. And I'm going to ask this question again at the end, but I want you to start considering which moments in your life can you remember that were your thin places? Where you just felt heaven and earth were just kind of starting to touch. Maybe it was a moment of worship. Maybe some place in the wilderness where God spoke to you. Maybe, I know for me, one of mine was when my children were born. And you just, like, life is just happening. And everything else kind of fades. Where are your thin places? Moving on, another altar calling, God's promises, the celebration of God's promises. Because God reaffirms this promise to Abram in this place, to your offspring I will give this land. To your offspring I will give this land. So what does this promise mean? It means a lot of things. First of all, this promise means that Lot, though beloved by Abram, will not be the path for God's blessing. Did you notice at the beginning of what we read today, it mentions not once but twice that Lot comes with him, that Abram brings Lot. Now part of that, I think, is to set up what's going to happen with Lot here in the near future, but part of it is just to show that Abram, who is childless, don't forget, I think looks upon Lot with a lot of love, treating him like a son. But God's promise reveals that as beloved as Lot may be, that is not the path of blessing God is choosing. It's another reminder that Sarai's barrenness will not last forever. It's a promise that's received by Abram but won't be realized in his lifetime. To your offspring, I will give this land. You may not see all the fruits of this, but those who come after you will. And it's a promise that's given while the enemy is still in control of the land. All right? Did you notice that really quick mention in verse 6, who's still in the land? The Canaanites are still there. And so Abram is walking around believing God's promise as though he's in the midst of enemy territory. And you know what? So are you. You're walking around a place where the enemy of God still has tremendous power. But God is still present with you, just as he was with Abram. God is still calling you to believe in the promise, though sometimes we look around and wonder about the world that we live in. So consider these questions. We'll revisit them at the end. In what ways has God fulfilled his promises to you? And maybe what promises are you still waiting to see fulfilled by God? Another calling of this altar that Abram builds, when he builds his second one, we're told that he raises his voice. We're told that he called on the name of the Lord when he built this second altar. And what I love about this one is that Abram's worship of God, we can see firsthand, was both action and word, not one or the other. Because when Abram felt and celebrated God's presence, he built an altar with his hands, but he also raised his voice. And if you think that Christianity is just about one or the other, about voicing your praise for God, or just living it out with your life, it's about both. Action and words, raising your voice. We don't know if Abram shouted or spoke or sang. We don't know. But we do know that he responded to God's provision thus far, maybe the promises that were coming in the future, and maybe he's speaking out or singing about his continued need for God to watch over him because this journey is far from over. But whatever it is, at this place, at this altar, we're told that Abram lifts his voice, raises his voice, and he calls out to God. Which leads us to ask, what kind of things are leading us to call out to God, whether in gratitude or in need? Because we still can call out to this God that Abram called out to. And then lastly, I believe that these altars are calling us to remember that we need to bless the next generation. We need to bless the next generation. We're entering an interesting period of history right now because we're entering a time period where I believe children will have no idea what a phone booth is. No clue. Sometimes we'll watch an older show on television and the kids will say, "What is that?" No clue what a phone booth is. Phone booths. You guys still know what phone booths are, right? Good? CJ, probably not you. Do you know what a phone booth is? He's not sure. But a phone, it's something that's really lodged in our cultural memory, isn't it? I mean, something you expect, something that's normal, something that's natural. It had a really good 100-year run. Around the turn of the 20th century is when they started to get installed more regularly, and through the 20th century, they got used quite a bit. Companies would pay thousands of dollars to a city to allow them to install a phone booth, knowing that the revenue from the usage of that booth would be huge because nobody had these magical devices in their pockets that could make phone calls yet. And so these companies paid thousands of dollars, and they went up everywhere. They're so lodged in our cultural consciousness that they're part of our entertainment even, right? There's one particular character, if you remember, he needs to use a phone booth in order to have a sort of costume change. Anybody? Yeah, Superman. Superman and phone booth just simply go together. You watch the cartoons or the shows, and you know that's a connection. Now, a little bit lesser connection that maybe some of you know, there's a couple guys named Bill and Ted who went on quite an excellent adventure, and it involved a phone booth. Not quite as well known, probably, as the one from the Superman days. But they're lodged, those ideas of phone booths, they are lodged in our collective cultural memories. But today, they're almost extinct. The phone booths that do exist are being converted to Wi-Fi hotspots, or they're being kept around just because of the ad revenue that they provide. People actually make 3 times more money on ad revenue from the phone booth than they do from people actually using the phone booth. So why do I say all this? Because passing a phone booth today is simply now an opportunity to tell the kids or the grandkids, about the time before everybody had a phone in their pocket, right? That's all they really represent, is a way to have an opportunity to tell a story to kids or grandkids or great-grandkids about what life was like before cell phones and why phone booths were important. And what I want you to know about these altars that Abram is building is that this is not the only time that he will pass by these places in his journey. And I fully believe that each time Abram passes these altars with his caravan that, spoiler alert, will eventually include children, it is an opportunity for Abram to tell the story of God's presence in his life. Every time his caravan passes that altar, I can just see one of the kids or grandkids saying, "Grandpa Abe, Grandpa Abe, what's that pile of rocks over there?" And him having the opportunity to say, "In this place, at this one time, let me tell you about how God showed up in a powerful way." What kinds of stories are you telling your children and your grandchildren to strengthen their faith? So let's close with these four questions that I want us to consider before we sing a couple more songs together. I've already asked all of them to get you thinking, but I want to put them all up on the screen for just a moment. First of all, what moments in your life can you point to that were thin places for you? Those places where it seemed like heaven and earth were colliding because God's presence was so real. In what ways has God fulfilled his promises to you? Or maybe what promises are you still waiting to see fulfilled? Maybe like Abram, you're celebrating some, and maybe you're waiting for more to be realized. What kinds of things are leading you to call out to God, whether it's in gratitude or in need? Abram called out to God around these altars that he built. And then lastly, like we just spoke about, what kinds of stories are you telling your children or your grandchildren to strengthen their faith? How are you utilizing these phone booth moments, these altar moments, to bless that next generation with the way you've experienced life with God? So what I'd like to do is take our normal time of reflection to pray, to consider these questions, and then I'm going to pray to close us, and then we're going to have a couple more songs, and we are going to actually do some altar building ourselves to kind of come right off the sermon, and I'm going to explain that in a moment. But for now, just take a moment of silence to consider these things, and then I'm going to pray, and we'll sing.